This recording is a production of the Conservative Anabaptist Education Committee. This presentation was recorded at Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute 2022, held at Horizon Mennonite School in Hagerstown, Maryland, on March 4 and 5.
There once was a boy who his parents decided to send him to school. And they knew it would be a little bit of a challenge, and so they had arranged for him to have regular support at the school for him. So he went to first grade, and just like he did at home, he broke pencils, and he threw fits. He spit in his classmates' faces and traumatized them to the point that he needed to be kept at home. That boy is my son. Today, I would like to talk to you about understanding children from difficult backgrounds. And this is a subject that, of course, is close to my heart. And I hope to communicate it, at least some things that will motivate and inspire you as school leaders to care for these children. Just last evening, my wife got another message from a lady in Des Moines. Somehow she got my wife's contact information. My dad just had a seizure, and he's in the ER. The stress of my brother is literally killing him, and this makes me so sad. Her brother is adopted, has been diagnosed with FASD, and the family is coming apart at the seams. Recent data suggests that nearly 25 million Americans aged 12 or older are current illicit drug users. The pattern of rates of current illicit drug use among young adolescent females has grown to where they are now more likely than males in their age group to be current non-medical users of psychoactive drugs. And there's a growing body of research that links challenges that children born to these using mothers, the challenges that they will have are challenges that are very difficult to overcome, maybe on par even with fetal alcohol spectrum. The challenges are great. I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about the brain damage that comes from trauma-based brain damage. And then I'm going to talk some about the adoption wound. The adoption wound is a term often used to help us understand what someone who is adopted, what kinds of things they feel and experience. And then I'm going to spend a fair amount of time on FASD and the presenting challenges that come with that. And then towards the end, I would like to inspire us or have us consider our role as schools a little more carefully. And then finally, I'd like to open it up for Q&A, at least if we have a little bit of time at the end. what does trauma do to a brain? And a lot of this has been compiled by my wife. She could talk more succinctly about any of this than what I can. She's not here, so I will do my best. When a person, whether in utero or after they're born, as a baby, an infant, or a child, experiences trauma, hormone levels in the body change. Cortisol and adrenaline are stress hormones that were given for our benefit as humans. They help us to react to perceived threats or danger or actual danger by directing blood flow to major muscle groups and actually bypassing the executive or thinking part of our brain. So that's great when we need it or in situations that are necessary. For example, the father of Chief Brian Miller that was able to lift the snapper lawnmower off of his son in order to save him, but couldn't before or since ever budge the thing. Okay, that's a result of an increased level of stress hormone. But what happens to a person's brain when the body is producing elevated levels of these stress hormones for prolonged periods? This can be, again, in utero or after birth. And stress hormones are triggered by stress, by perceived threats. And we know that babies, even in the womb, can keenly sense threats. The prolonged activation of stress hormones reduces neural connections in the thinking area of the brain. These areas of the brain that are dedicated to reasoning and learning. So, prolonged exposure to those stress or from those stress hormones actually damages the brain, especially because the brain isn't fully developed. It can affect other organs, causing lifelong physical and mental health problems. Continuous trauma can weaken remaining neural pathways to the thinking part of your brain and strengthen neural pathways to the survival part. Okay, so continuous repeated trauma, whether that is happening to the mother, whether it's happening to the actual infant, but it's perceived as trauma, it's experienced as trauma, it weakens the neural pathways that you need for executive functioning, and it strengthens, that means built up to an abnormally strengthened position, the pathways that have to do with the survival part of our brain. And so, children that have these kinds of brain damages will typically not be able to do school well. But you throw them a curveball and they could knock the school over with one swing. Right? This is one of the reasons. So from this, from that damage then comes anger and frustration and attachment issues. This is all so far from Amanda Merk, Master in Public Health. Plasticity of the brain, or the ability to heal, is better if it's just trauma-based. So as we move into from trauma-based to alcohol and drug-based brain damage, it's important to remember that plasticity is better when is just trauma-based, but there's still brain damage. Okay, now I want to move over next into the adoption wound. What is the adoption wound? What are we talking about? So, grief, separation, and loss are what we feel when a parent is gone, right? So if you can imagine yourself as a child up through adolescent, imagine yourself losing a parent. And you weren't expecting it, you didn't do anything to deserve it, but you lost a parent for some reason. Think of the grief and the separation, the loss that you will feel. This grief and separation and loss that is felt is more profound in someone that's adopted than in someone that actually loses their parent. And the reason is because not only did they lose their parent, but that parent might still be alive and just isn't either able or interested in caring for them. So having your dad be absent, away somewhere doing something else, not really thinking or caring about where you are and that you're with another family now, is worse than if your dad was dead. So that is going to cause challenges for the child. We as adoptive families often think that the adoption day is something to be celebrated. Like we would have maybe adoption birthday for the child. Recently, my wife was reading an account of someone written by an adopted person, and they said, you have to understand that for me, adoption day was one of the worst days of my life, and I couldn't figure out why every year my family wanted to keep repeating this memory. Like, why would you celebrate the day you lost your family forever? Ignoring or minimizing this will not be helpful. Think of would you say to your neighbor who has a 10-year-old, would you say to that 10-year-old, if that 10-year-old's father died in a car crash today, would you, and you could provide a home for that child, would you go to them and say, it's a good day, you can come to our house now and we'll even teach you about Jesus? Would you have that attitude toward the 10-year-old who was from, let's say, a pagan or non-believing home? As if you could rescue them and make things better now, and yeah, your dad died, but hey, you can live with us. We wouldn't consider relating to somebody in that sort of way. So some of the challenges or the experiences, the emotions that are felt because of the adoption wound are anger, denial. How do you as a young person talk to somebody about having a dad that doesn't care about you? I mean, can a 10-year-old boy talk about that? And so it's very difficult. So denial is often the route chosen. Anxiety, fear of abandonment. I mean, if my dad, him and my mother gave birth to me, he didn't care about me, how can you prove, or how can I be certain that living with you is actually going to be sustained for any, you know, reasonable length of time? Especially if that child has gone through multiple foster homes. But fear of abandonment and fear of rejection are huge. And these produce behaviors that we find very challenging to address. Self-worth and identity. Who am I anyway? Who am I supposed to be? I mean, am I supposed to be the young man in downtown Kansas City who's running around on the street. I know that's where I'd be if I didn't have this adoptive family from southern Iowa, but I don't know, I'm not sure if I would really like that, but that's where my brothers are. I wonder if that's who I actually am. And somehow I'm stuck here in this conservative Mennonite home. Well, they love me, but I don't know. I'm just not sure if that's who I am or not. Well, these are kinds of questions that are going through these children's mind continuously. And of course, there are genetic differences, cultural differences. And our son, by the way, I did speak with him and ask him if it's okay if I use stories from our experience. And he said, yes, Dad, you may. He said, I would like to help anybody. So I appreciate that. But genetic differences, he's black, and he has rhythm that we Germans just know nothing about. He'd pick up a guitar and play it without any formal training, and just, you know, without a lot of experience could play much better than most of us could hope to attain to. Cultural differences. I don't know why nobody in our county wants to lower the Honda and spray paint the wheels a different color. Nobody. But our son would like to do that. I didn't know where that comes from. Something somewhere told him that's the way we do cars. Didn't get it from me. Those are differences. Attachment issues. So now I'm going to go down through a quick list here, and you may or may not recognize these from children that come into your schools. But when I talk about attachment issues, you know, we all have attachment issues to some degree, but most of them aren't apparent enough. But when we talk about attachment issues, we're talking about observing behaviors that have gotten to be fairly extreme. And so then we try to identify where those come from. But not being able to trust, wanting to resist relationship, and so on. Being clingy or needy, hostile toward parents or primary caregivers. This is very, very typical. And you will not see this if you're just the school administrator, unless the child is in your school long enough for his teacher to maybe qualify as a primary caregiver. But usually it's the mom that takes the brunt of this. The child might be super nice to the teacher, super nice to his classmates, at least initially, but back home, his mom has bruises on her legs, all right? That's very typical. Aggressive behavior, lack of remorse for actions. How can you do that and not feel sorry for it? Any human with half a soul would regret that. But I don't. Why not? I don't seem to be able to regret that. Well, it doesn't make sense. Destructive to self and others. I still remember the time we had a nice octagonal glass table. I bought it cheap at an auction. It was a prize of mine. And my son broke it with a table fork. If you hit hard enough, long enough, you can break quarter-inch glass. Destructive to self and others without much remorse, if any. Impulsive. Steals, questions everything, especially anything related to authority. Does not consider consequences of actions. Immature speech, may have learning delays, and especially trouble with math and science. And that is because of the particular brain damage that happens from trauma. But these present themselves, and we call them attachment disorders. Food issues, gorging, hoarding, hiding, unhealthy fascination by violence, blood, and weapons. And I don't understand how this where this comes from, but my son would be freaked out about an airplane. I mean, if he happened to see an airplane that might look like a military plane, I mean, he is running for cover. But at the same time, he will play and he will make light of violence, and he will talk like he's going to kill and so on. So very fascinated by it, at the same time, extremely paranoid of it. So because of the loss that adopted children have experienced, they are, and some of the brain damage that often has occurred, they're going to be at a higher risk for ADHD, for substance abuse, for learning disabilities, for depression, for anxiety disorders, and mental health disorders. So they're at a higher risk. It doesn't mean that they'll have them, but they are at a higher risk. Anybody can get these disorders, or anybody can succumb to them. Whatever you want to call them, disorders or sins or troubles, but anybody can succumb to them. But these children coming from difficult places are at a very elevated risk for these. I'm going to talk a little bit about FASD now. What are some of the presenting characteristics of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder? So it used to be believed that if you took a baby at birth, looked at them, and couldn't identify any of the markers typically associated with fetal alcohol spectrum, and you asked the mother if she had been exposed to alcohol during pregnancy and she said no, then it's probably okay. It turns out that a lot of times mothers lie, and some brain damage that occurs from fetal alcohol exposure is often not visible by physical markers. And if it is, it often goes away soon or in time after birth. So there is ongoing research to try to identify what the markers are and how to get an accurate diagnosis. Now, you and I might be sitting here saying, well, why do we need a diagnosis for FASD? And I would say we typically don't. I mean, if they have these presenting behaviors, you're going to have to work with them one way or another, whether they're diagnosed with FASD or not. And so you're going to work with it as if they are, even if they didn't. But the reason why FASD diagnosis is important is because in the public system, it's your access to services. So that's why it's a big deal. And we're, like I said, we're not necessarily concerned with that. Functional dysmaturity is a hallmark of FASD. What this means, dysmaturity, is that maturity occurs in different areas at different times, and it's not related. So here's a quote from Diane Malbin. A person with FASD will simultaneously exhibit behaviors common to people of different ages. For example, someone with FASD might be 18 years of age, sound like a 22-year-old in their verbal ability, act like a 6-year-old in a social and moral sense, read like a young teen, and understand time and money about the same level as a 12-year-old. People with FASD tend to catch up to themselves as much as they are going to by their early to mid 30s. And that early to mid 30s is a fairly common number. Some would say if you can keep them out from under a bridge or out of prison up through age 25, they have a reasonable chance of living a productive adult life. But the difficulty is up to that point. And then, of course, training them and helping them to learn relational skills that will enable them to continue on, even maybe when they're not with mom and dad or primary caregiver anymore. So functional dysmaturity is very common. Our son, for example, can spell better than a high schooler, but he can do math on about a third grade level. He has social skills that to make me look a little slow, to be frank, and he can make friends about wherever he goes. But his ability to understand cause and effect, as it relates to money, for example, is, I don't know, maybe eight or nine years old. I have a nephew who's, I think he just turned eight, and my sister-in-law commented the other day that her son and our son seem to progress in some things at about the same age level, even though our son is 7 years older. Impulsivity and distractibility is a hallmark of FASD. So the time in between stimulus and response is very, very short. And that is a result of the brain damage that occurs in the corpus callosum, the ability for the brains to communicate with each other. And so there's a stimulus, and what we would perceive as a normal response time, where you process, you make a decision, and you have an execution or an action, is just extremely short for someone with FASD. And the action usually, or often, when it's a strong stimulus, it ends up being an action that the person will regret. The functioning of the decision process was broken down for some reason. On the other hand, when it comes to math and science and some of those executive functions, the processing pace is very slow. And they will say, what? Memory problems and inconsistent performance. So to teach someone to do something, if they have brain damage from FAS, you might just remember that it's going to take about seven times longer. It's not that they can't learn, it's not that they can't make the connection between cause and effect, but it's going to be a lot longer. And as an example, for us, we have a farm, we pack eggs at our hen house, and I taught Ventress to pack eggs when he was around 12 or 13. And it's a fairly simple process. There's a few electronic things to manage, but it's really pretty simple. But for him to be able to master that and be able to do that without my direct intervention, it took repeated help. And we had eggs on the ceiling, we had eggs on the walls, we had, you know, language that would make a sailor squirm, etc., till we finally get to where he can pack the eggs and push the button at the right time and know what to do if a feather gets in the way and just keep it going. All right? In contrast to that, I have other sons that are 5 and 7, and they both know how to pack eggs. It took me one half of one choring to teach them, and they're good to go. So that wasn't because my older son didn't want to learn to pack eggs, but his ability to understand and to deal with the multiple challenges of that machine are much more elevated because of his brain damage. So because of that, we see they're easily fatigued and easily frustrated. Overwhelmed can take several different presenting behaviors, maybe under the table, or it may be just breaking the table in half, wanting to burn the chicken. I mean, the way to solve the problem with this one egg that's broken is just to burn the chicken house down. That's what would actually solve this problem. So overwhelmed, and then that results in being argumentative and resistant. Sexual problems are elevated with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Sexual urges impulses, and especially in social situations. Should school boards, should school administrators know this? Should they pay attention? Absolutely. Should dads know this? Definitely. Is this a reason to throw our hands in the air and say we can't to go forward? No. But we do need to be aware. You can't assume that they will make the best decision in any given situation. You have to manage them and the space around them as best you can. We could go into detail there, but I think the brother this afternoon might talk a little bit more there. I'm going to read here a paragraph from the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board. Fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol effects are disorders that occur as a result of the consumption of alcohol during pregnancy. The alcohol molecule is very tiny and passes easily across the placenta from mother to baby as early as 2 weeks after conception until birth. So in other words, this can happen before the woman knows that she's pregnant. Although the alcohol can affect the development of all cells and organs, the brain is particularly vulnerable to the effects of alcohol exposure, and damage can occur throughout pregnancy. Much more is being learned about that. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of it coming to public light. And without being too cynical, we just need to understand there's a lot of money in the alcohol business. And I don't know if this practice or this habit is going to change. There's different people mobilizing, trying to get more education out, but education doesn't necessarily seem to be effective. I just have a more of a list of things here that are presenting behaviors from children with fetal alcohol spectrum. Difficulty with abstract concepts like time. Understanding how much time it would take and being able to make decisions about that. Self-monitoring is frequently not working well, needs or requires policing. Roller coaster emotions. And so you'll have a good week and then you'll have a bad week. And in the middle of your bad week, you'll just think, I'm gonna die. There's no way that I can survive another week or year. And then the next week is a little better. And so it goes like that. That is very typical for children with fetal alcohol spectrum challenges. Dr. Ira Chasnoff, he is the foremost researcher in this field as we speak. He has cited research which found that 60 to 80% of children adopted from foster care have fetal alcohol or drug exposure. This number is significantly higher than what most have admitted or considered up to this point. But he has access to advanced scanning equipment and technology that has actually led to his 60 to 80% number, which is huge. Prenatal exposure for international adoptions vary by country, with the countries of the former Eastern Bloc having the highest exposure. Most of these were either missed or misdiagnosed. 86% of them possibly misdiagnosed as not having that fetal alcohol spectrum, but in fact actually having it. The IDEAL study found that prenatal meth exposure was associated with child externalizing behavioral problems at 5 years and parenting stress and psychological symptoms experienced by primary caregivers were associated with increased child behavioral problems, indicating these affected children. And up until now, there hasn't been a lot of of consensus, there still isn't consensus, but does meth use actually affect the child long term? And Chasnoff says absolutely yes. Indicating these affected children may have more difficulties negotiating the increasing complex academic and social demands of school-aged children. So, what about us as schools? Should we care? If you look at the challenges that these children bring, especially if it's the adoption wound combined with brain damage from trauma and or fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, the challenges are huge. There will be a handout available, I think they're going to put it out on the table, that has a list of resources for you to consider. And my wife put that together. Her email and telephone number is also at the top of that. I put that on there. I didn't get permission. But you are welcome to contact us. But we are by no means experts. We can share stories. But where was I going with that? Yes. The challenges are growing. At the top of that list of resources are two books by Dr. Karen Purvis, who's now deceased, the Karen Purvis Institute. We would highly recommend. She has promoted trust-based interventions, which is some of the best advice that you can get, whether you're a parent or a school administrator or principal. But I will hasten to say that I know people younger than us that have employed her methods as best they could in the best possible sort of ways, and their children are still presenting behaviors that are challenging. There is no silver bullet, but there are resources on that page. So what should we as schools do? So the book of Proverbs has various descriptors of people that it calls, or that the writer called, fools. And if you have experience with children with both reactive attachment disorder and fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, you will discover that they fit those descriptions almost perfectly. I don't know if the writer of Proverbs knew who he was talking about or not. I don't know if that was a problem back then, but from the Proverbs perspective, I don't know if we have a lot of hope. There's some places where it says, just leave the fool alone because you're gonna get hurt to yourself if you try to help him. Well, we know what that's like. Okay, is that the end of the story? Should that be the end of the story for us as schools? What are we going to do when this epidemic is only growing? And should we, as plain people, should we be encouraging adoptions of these sort of children? And if yes, then should our schools pay attention to understanding and trying to help? And again, the answer is yes. Information. I gave you quite a bit of information. And I have some stories up here on the screen I was going to go through. These are recent Facebook posts that come to my wife's account. And these are stories that come from recent, just very recent posts. And these are mainly people that have fetal alcohol spectrum disorder children. And we could read more of these stories. I don't have time, but I could read stories, I could give you examples. And I suppose many of you could stand up and give us stories. But what I would like for us to consider is that information is not actually the key to helping. In order for us to understand, we must first love. understanding doesn't come as a result of reading books, although people who love and want to understand will read books and will try to gain information. We could look at this as a national problem, and we could just wish it would go away. And we could say, well, we don't live those sort of lifestyles, so why should we expend our resources trying to fix those problems? And I think I don't have to defend my position that that is not the way of Christ. This might be the defining moment for the Plain People. I'm told, right out of an old order man's mouth from Holmes County, Ohio, the old order Amish in Holmes County, old and new order, are rising to the top of the list of the people the social services will call first when they have multiple placements at a time, so multiple children from one family. And the reason for that is they've seen the most success from placing them in those families. The best research shows that the families capable and most likely to succeed in helping children like this are large families with firmly established traditions in which the child that they take in is close to the youngest or the youngest. We are in a position, or we could have been, but what will history say about our decision on this challenge? And will we take the path that Christ would take? It's not a problem. It's an opportunity. What are your questions? The clock says we have a minute. It's not optional, it's not convenient, it is absolutely critical. These children will triangulate every chance they get. That means they will pit the school against the parents, against someone else, or against themselves, and they are masters at doing it. And the only way to move forward with that is constant, regular communication. They will convince the teacher that mom's a jerk, and they will convince the mom that the teacher's a jerk, and then if you believe them, it's all gonna go downhill really quick. Yes, good point. Yes.
So if your son were here, would he shape the group? Would he encourage us to do?
That's a good question. I will ask him, but I think he would say, just care about the people. I don't know, but that's good.
Hey, Arnold.
Yeah.
What was that question?
The question was, if my son were here, my 16-year-old son, what would he say if he had this audience? And my answer was, I don't know, but I think he would say, you need to care about us.
I really appreciate your thoughts. I practice emergency medicine, and we live in a rural area. We have a very significant alcohol and opioid epidemic in our area. Mm. And so we see this all the time. And so easy. It's very easy to be very critical of the mother who used the alcohol and used the opioids while she was pregnant. But these things go back generations, and I can tell you sad story after sad story after sad story after sad story. This is a significant issue that is a huge mission opportunity for the Plain People that we are letting sit, that we need substantial education among our Plain People to help with the opioid crisis in our nation, which is very significant. But at the end of the day, the grace of God is the great equalizer. And what I mean by that is this: the grace of God is what enables us to, with the difficult situations, and bring the blessings that we have had and the compassion that we have had into the lives of these people and bless these people.
Yes.
And bring a reasonable degree of equality into those experiences. And that's our calling as Christians.
Yes. Totally. Yes, I 100% agree with that. And I would just add that grace of God and that coming comes through multiple people or the brotherhood engaging. For us to individually deliver the grace is not sustainable. We must be together, encouraging each other.